Hebrews chapter 11 has defined faith for us, and it's exemplified faith. It's given us examples of what faith looks like. So the beginning of that chapter, it defined what it was to keep going. Remember, the letter of Hebrews is about people who need to keep going because there was a danger they were going to give up because of their persecution, because of the pressure of their friends and colleagues and family members who were Jews, calling them back, or Gentiles, telling them that none of this made sense at all. So they're being called to keep going and to show this kind of faith. Recently, a couple of weeks ago, we looked at Abraham, who exemplified this faith that believed God, even though he couldn't see how things were going to work out. And then the faith of Isaac and the faith of Jacob and, of Joseph. And all of those were looking forward to a city whose architect and builder is God. That's what the writer tells us. And if you think about it, the writer in Hebrews 11, he's weaving together two different themes, really, he has two purposes. As this chapter unfolds, of course he's showing them that what they have with Jesus is what all those people who are living by faith were looking forward to. So what they've got is something perfect in that it's complete. Jesus has come and it's all complete. So for that reason alone, don't give up and go back to something inferior. So that's going on in chapter 11. But at the same time in Hebrews 11, of course, it's examples of what it means to keep going, what it looks like to persevere and to keep going. It's the faith that pleases God. It's the faith that believes in the existence and the character of God. He's there, and he rewards those who earnestly seek him. If you really believe that God exists, if you really believe that God is the rewarder of those who earnestly seek him, if you really believe that in Jesus Christ there is the full and final revelation from God, if you have that kind of faith, what difference does it make? What difference should it make? These people in chapter 11, they acted on their faith. And really that question about what difference does it make gets much more intense as you get towards the end of chapter 11, particularly those first few verses that we'll get to in a few moments. An intensity of saying, what should your faith look like? What should your faith look like? How does it look when you persevere because you see him who's invisible? This text, though, is not here to condemn us this evening and say, you've got rubbish faith. Look at them. Heroic people, look at you. Just a little single cell in the area of faith. It's not there for that. It's there to show you what faith looks like in the lives of ordinary people. Ordinary heroes. People who, by God's grace, maybe are notable, but some who are not. Don't even know their names. But we know that they live by faith and they're a great example to us, and they're the faith that we can aspire to. We can exercise faith like this. Not big faith, but faith in a really big God. So this text is about encouraging ordinary people to get wrapped up in extraordinary events as God uses us. Not superheroes of faith, men and women of faith who are examples of strength in weakness. So let's think about them together for a few minutes. First of all then, faith in the life of Moses, verse 23 through to 28. See, first of all, faith in Moses' parents there in verse 23. His parents, and probably the way the word's used, particularly his mum, realizes that there's something special about this boy. Don't know quite what that expression means, where it says he was a special child. Some translations have that he was beautiful, very unusual to look at or something. We don't know quite what they saw, but God helped the parents of Moses see there was something unique about him. So they did something that none of the other Jewish people, the Israelite people, were doing, which was to preserve his life, even though the king wanted them all dead. And they would die probably if they were found out. Faith overcome their natural fear of the consequences. That's verse 23. And then in verse 24 through to 26, we see Moses' choices because of his faith. Moses has this privileged upbringing. He grows up as part of the Egyptian royal family. Maybe one day he could be some kind of a ruler in Egypt. We don't know what the prospects were for him as he lived as part of the royal family. And he made, don't know, over time, but of course there's some particular incidents we read about in the book of Exodus. But he came to a point of a conscious decision to associate himself with the Israelites rather than live a life of pleasure and luxury. And of course we know he worked it out in a rather clumsy way, and the people of Israel didn't at first believe that he was at all their saviour. They just saw him as a murderer, and he got into trouble and had to escape. But his faith, we know from here, from the way Stephen talks about it in the book of Acts, and from, of course, the book of Exodus itself, that his faith persists. And he leaves Egypt, verse 27. By faith he left Egypt. Maybe talking about the first time, maybe talking about both times when he leaves Egypt. First of all on his own, secondly with the people of Israel. And the reason he did that was because he saw an invisible God. In any language, that's kind of a pun, a kind of a question mark sort of phrase, isn't it? He saw him who was invisible. He heard the word of God and he believed it. So by faith, he saw God exists, God rewards. And here's the calculation behind his choices. See that in verse 26. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead for his reward. How far he was looking ahead, perhaps is not clear. But certainly, he was not looking for his reward in Egypt. He wasn't saying, safe life, rich life, pleasurable life, part of the royal family of Egypt, that's my reward. Doesn't say that. He looks for his reward elsewhere, doesn't he? He calculates and he says, I can cope with the disgrace. I can cope with the running as a fugitive. I can cope with having to confront Pharaoh later. I can cope with all of that. I can cope with wandering across the desert, because I'm making a calculation here that knowing God, that fearing God's miles better than fearing Pharaoh. And the writer reads Christ back into the story. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ, verse 26, as of better than all the value of the treasure of Egypt. Maybe for the sake of Christ means, well, this is part of the story that gets us to Christ, isn't it? You know, if the Israelites hadn't come out of Egypt, then the nation would never have been born and Jesus would never have been born. So maybe he's just saying as part of the story, he does it for the sake of Christ. Probably more likely, he's just thinking in much more general way that he's serving the purposes of Christ and he's serving Christ. You remember in Corinthians that Paul says that the rock that was the fountain providing water in the desert for the Israelites, that rock was Christ. Christ, and we can debate precisely how that all works out, and maybe we never quite know till we get to heaven, but Christ is there in the Old Testament. He's the Savior. He's orchestrating all that's going on. The whole Trinity is involved in the Old Testament as well as in the New Testament. So his choice ultimately is a choice whether he wants to serve Christ or whether he wants to serve Pharaoh. So theologically, he's reading it back in there. That's okay to do that. But of course, he's saying the name of Christ, because it really then connects with the experience of the people who are reading this letter. Disgrace for the sake of Christ compared with value and treasure. Maybe they'd lost their jobs. Maybe they'd lost their friends. Maybe they'd lost their family as companions. Maybe they were put out of the synagogue. Maybe they were excluded from all kinds of social gatherings. Maybe they'd even been harmed. Maybe some of them, we know some of them, had been imprisoned. Disgrace for the sake of Christ. How are they going to calculate that? Well, I'd rather be comfortable now. I'd rather not be imprisoned and have a job. I'd rather have lots of friends. I'd rather be accepted in the synagogue. I'd rather be accepted by my family. I don't want to be disgraced for the sake of Christ. But Moses made a different calculation. He said, I don't mind being disgraced. I don't choose disgrace, but I don't mind being disgraced because I'm choosing to follow Christ. Moses keeps the Passover, verse 28. Moses had to explain the Passover to the people. He had to take the lead in keeping this ceremony. A ceremony that, of course, we've read it a few times, probably most of us, and we kind of understand it. But a ceremony that would have meant pretty much nothing to them. But Moses, as the leader, and of course the people, have to exercise faith. They had to believe that God really was going to send this destroying angel. They had to believe that the procedure that they went through, all this choosing a particular animal and sacrificing it and getting blood and putting it over the doorpost, they had to believe that that procedure was going to work. And Moses had to take the lead and say, yep, it really is going to work. The destroying angel really is going to come, and the firstborn of Israel really are going to be saved. If you exercise faith, if you follow me in this and do this, you'll be safe. And he does it. And it works. So how are you with reckoning and choosing? Can you see beyond the immediate? Can you trust an unseen God so you move forward in faith? Have you started to calculate that an angry God is to be feared much more than an angry friend? That the respect of God is much more important than the respect of all other earthly powers? And is that faith affecting your choices all the time? Every day we're making little choices and big choices to say, what am I choosing at this moment? Here I am, I'm at school. Here I am, I'm in the office. Here I am, I'm with my friends or with my family. And all the time, through every day this week, you'll be making choices. Are they choices that exercise faith? I want to follow Christ. I don't mind the disgrace. Or are they choices which exercise no faith, which say, my reward is here. I need to feel secure. I need to feel safe. I need to be loved. I need to be accepted. I don't want to do anything that endangers any of those things. What choices are you making? How are you going to calculate tomorrow? This chapter is crying out to you. Calculate like Moses calculates. Reckoning disgrace for the sake of Christ is much better than the pleasures of sin for a while. Moses suffers, of course, indirectly for the sake of Christ, but for us, it's more obvious. Are you willing to say, Jesus really is my security? Do you want reward now, which is pretty average? Or are you looking for reward later, which is inexpressible? So faith in the life of Moses was the first thing. Secondly, faith expressed by the infant nation of Israel from verse 29. Moses leads the people out after the Passover, and they face immediately great challenges, don't they? The Egyptians are about to ambush them, they're chasing after them. The sea is their only escape route, and yet there's this massive body of water, whatever precise bit of the Red Sea or the Sea of Reeds or whatever it is, it stands in their way. They can't get across, they can't escape the Egyptians. And Moses calls for the people not to be afraid. He says to them to stand firm. In other words, to keep believing in God. God will fight for them, and he does. God, in a completely unexpected way, breaking the natural order of things, he makes a path through the sea. And they pass safely through, and the Egyptians are drowned. And the difference is that the Israelites at this point exercise faith in weakness. They grumble at Moses. They say, well, you brought us here just to kill us. But at that crucial moment, as Moses rallies them and says, follow, they follow. and they cross. They exercise faith that God's going to save them, that he's going to part, and that he is going to keep the waters from them as they go across. And that faith saves them. And later, they're to march around this fortified city of Jericho. There's no way in through any doors. They've got no conception of how this marching round is going to persuade the walls to come down. And yet they do it. This almost ridiculous procedure, kind of laying themselves open to attack as they march around for 7 days, and then a lot more on the final day, round and round Jericho, and they just shout. And it wasn't so much noise that it sent some sort of sound wave that broke all the walls down, was it? It was this great miracle that God exercises because they've exercised faith themselves. Rahab's added there to the list, I guess because she's contrasted with the unbelievers. See that in verse 31. By faith, the prostitute Rahab. If you remember, she was one of the citizens of Jericho. And she believes that the God of Israel is the true God. She's heard about him. She puts her faith in him. She wants to side with him. She makes a calculation. And compared with all the unbelievers, perhaps the writer's thinking about the unbelievers in the city of Jericho. Perhaps he's thinking about the unbelievers amongst the spies who first came out to suss out the land and Jericho. But with all unbelievers, she's contrasted because she believes. And she's safe. Perhaps even more ridiculous, it would seem, is that as the walls tumble down, her bit of the wall, her residence, is protected. She's kept safe as she exercises faith. So all these, Moses, the people, Rahab, they had to exercise faith in God's method to save. Faith in God's surprising method to save. The Passover, the crossing of the Red Sea, the tumbling down of the walls of Jericho. And here's a question for you. Do you trust God's method to save you? You really need saving. We all need saving. And the question is whether you're going to trust God's method to save you, if that's where you're going to locate your faith, or whether you're going to trust something else to save you. God's method, on the face of it, may seem quite ridiculous. It may seem primitive. It may seem ineffective. It may seem even unfair. It may seem to you perhaps even illogical. But are you going to exercise faith like Moses, like the Israelites, like Rahab, and say, I don't know how you're going to do this, but you're going to do it. I don't know quite how it worked out, but I know I need saving because I'm a sinner and because I don't love you like I should. And I know that you have said what I have to do is trust in Jesus. That's what we're going to remember in a few moments as we look, listen, sorry, as we look, we take the bread and the wine and we remember the words of Jesus. I know that Jesus on the cross pays the penalty for my sin and sets me free. I put my faith in that. Are you going to do that? Are you going to keep doing that? Faith in God's surprising method to save. So faith expressed by the infant nation of Israel. And then faith in the lives of ordinary heroes. It's a very dramatic text, written in a very kind of gripping way, isn't it, these closing verses? Some stories of deliverance, but really it ends in quite a dark way, doesn't it? From verse 32, it's about knowing great victories, even in weakness. So we see that the writer says, I haven't got time to talk about these people, but just to list a few off, other people who exercise faith, Gideon, Barak, Samson, and Jephthah. You can read about them in the book of Judges. They were men of weakness, They were men of failure. They were men who sinned. And yet God used them to bring about great deliverance as they exercised faith. You think about Samson. He seems such a disaster in his personal life, doesn't he? We thought about it not so long ago as we worked through the book of Judges. His temperament seems so up and down. But there are key moments, particularly the end of his life as he pushes those pillars down and many Philistines perish with him, when he cries out to God and he believes God exists and God rewards those who earnestly seek him. People exercising faith and seeing great deliverance from God. And you know what? Some of our Christian life will be times of great victories, great strength, even in weakness. There will be times where we are delivered, or even sometimes we are the deliverer, that we're involved in God's work of delivering, of saving, of helping others. Sometimes we will face times of great victory. Here are some of the people who, through faith, conquered kingdoms, administered justice, gained what was promised, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Women received their dead raised to life again. Some of our Christian lives will be an obvious breakthrough despite trials. Sometimes God will bless us in a very obvious and clear way now through faith. That may happen in our personal lives. That may happen in our church life. That by faith, as we call out to God and we say, I know you're there and I know you reward those who earnestly seek you. Please bless our work to tell my friends, to tell my family, to tell our contacts around the church, to explain the gospel to the children. Please give them spiritual life. Please have mercy, Lord. And we cry out in faith, really believing that God will do that. And God often does bless and give great victories. And the church marches forward as a mighty army. Only by faith. And not by the strength of our faith. And not because we're amazing characters. We're much more at the Samson end than the David end, aren't we? But in weakness, we can be strong as we put our faith, as we locate our faith in God. But also, and it's so helpful to be there too, isn't it? That he talks about facing great trials that don't seem to have any deliverance in this life. After talking about women receiving back their dead, raised to life again, perhaps thinking about some of the stories in the book of Kings with Elijah and Elisha, it goes on to say, others were tortured and refused to be released so they might gain a better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging, where others were chained and put in prison. They were stoned, they were sawn in two. Not sure how genuine this is, but it's thought that Jeremiah, the prophet Jeremiah, was stoned, and that the prophet Isaiah was sawn in two. They were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and ill-treated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains, and in caves and in holes in the ground. It seems when you get here like the list has taken a bit of a wrong turn, because so far, pretty much, all those who exercised faith saw deliverance. The people saw salvation as they crossed the Red Sea, as the walls of Jericho fell down, and so forth. Their faith realized something in this life, didn't it? They didn't receive all that was promised. We'll think about that again in a moment. But they received some of the things that were promised them. They saw some victory. But for these last people in the list, it's just torture and jeers and flogging and imprisonment and being stoned, being sawn in two, being killed, being destitute. And the writer here is pretty much reviewing Israel's history, the bits we know about from the Old Testament, and probably he's thinking about the bit in between the Old Testament ending and the New Testament starting. There was an awful lot of persecution, various nations who overran the area of Israel. There's one particular leader from Syria, Antiochus Epiphanes. There's lots written about him. He was a brutal king. He was someone who was prophesied in the book of Daniel. And particularly during that period, there was all these kind of things happening. Jeers and flogging, chain put in prison, stone sawn in two, put to death by the sword, people becoming refugees. All these things were happening during that time. But I think, I guess the writer is not just looking back into that period between the two testaments, but he's kind of surveying what would be church history. He's kind of thinking of the now, what was happening, beginning to happen in the lives of the Hebrews who were reading this. He's thinking about what's going to happen. And he's kind of surveying that whole scene and saying, for some of you, you're going to face great trials. And in those trials, you also need to exercise faith. We know they were people of faith. The end of verse 35. They were tortured and refused to be released so they might gain a better resurrection. They saw him who was invisible. They saw that the reward of the resurrection, of having a resurrected body and being in the presence of God, they saw that that was more valuable, so they were willing to give up their lives. Not foolishly, not recklessly, but they were willing to give up their lives because they made that calculation, just like Moses. Sometimes things will seem bleak. Christians will suffer. I couldn't really work out this week whether the statistic was true. It's certainly repeated in lots of different places. But if the statistic is at all true, there's a Christian martyr every 5 minutes. Every 5 minutes. So many people have died since we even came here this evening. 25 to 7, somebody died. 20 to 7, somebody else died for their faith. Many passing into glory, unnamed, not recognized by most in the world, not listed by name like the people here. Sometimes things will seem bleak and Christians will suffer. And the only way that means anything, the only way that that's not a complete tragedy and waste of a life is if there really is a resurrection. Otherwise, someone's just lost a husband or a father or a son or a wife for nothing, for standing up for some nonsense that they believe in. What's the point? But if it's true, then it wasn't all for nothing. It was people making a calculation and exercising faith. And we may see dark days. Perhaps we will not see days of suffering, but perhaps we will. But sometimes churches will close. Sometimes it will seem like the secular agenda will make advances and really encroach on our lives and make us suffer in some way and make us feel weak and downtrodden. Sometimes we will have personal failures. Sometimes we will get illnesses that we just don't get over and we can't understand what God's doing. Sometimes things will seem very hard and sometimes we will go to glory and the people observing it have not seen a victory, it would seem. But they really have. Because all these people were living by faith when they died. And seeing these examples who gave their all, we're encouraged to stand up and say, actually, the trials are not so bad. God is good to me, and I've kind of got a mixture. I'm knowing sometimes great victories, and I'm sometimes facing great trials. And I look at these examples, and I feel the emotion of this list as it ends, and think, well, in God's goodness, I haven't quite got there yet. My friends are not being stoned and killed and imprisoned at this point, although some are in the rest of the world. And I take their faith and I say, I want to exercise faith in my situation, it's actually even easier than it was for them. So I want to really say, I believe in the God who is there. I can't see him with my eyes, but I believe he's there. I believe he rewards. I believe that whatever anyone takes away from me, knowing him is more valuable. And even if people take away my life, that's not too much to give for him. And how will you calculate that? It's got to be by faith. Faith in the life of ordinary heroes. Are you an ordinary hero? Maybe your name will never appear anywhere. Maybe nobody will ever write a book about you. But are you an ordinary hero who in your particular life situation is exercising faith? And as we close this tremendous chapter, verse 39, it connects up with really the beginning. These were all commended for their faith. Remember verse 2, this is what the ancients were commended, same word, for. Yet none of them received what had been promised. That connects us up with verse 13. All these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. And it's like the writer's gathering all these things together and saying, all these people, they were commended by their faith. They received some things, but really when you put them all together, they didn't receive what was promised. So what's this chapter about? It's about encouraging you to exercise faith. They're a great example. They didn't receive what was promised. What was actually promised comes with Christ. So we're in a much better position with Jesus. But we haven't received all that's promised because we're not in the new heavens and the new earth, are we? So we're still waiting on the promises to be fulfilled. So we look at their example and we see they waited for what was promised. And some of them didn't see it in their lifetime. Sorry, all of them didn't see it in their lifetime. And the people who are reading this letter and us, we've seen something more because Jesus has come. But we haven't seen it all. And we're called to exercise faith as they exercise faith. Faith that waits. Faith that knows it will be rewarded. I know it says 29 on there, it's 39 and 40. Great examples of faith. Faith that didn't realize fully the promises. Their faith wasn't in vain because Jesus came. Our faith isn't in vain because Jesus is coming back. So are you trusting God? Are you trusting God when you look back and you say, I wasn't there, but I believe what you tell me about creation. I wasn't there, but I believe what you told me about Jesus dying on the cross for my sins. I'm not there yet, but I believe that if I have faith in Jesus, I will be a resident of the eternal city. In the new heavens and the new earth. I exercise faith in what's happened in the past. I exercise faith in what will be in the future. If you really believed like that, what difference would it make? If you believed that Jesus was coming back and every knee would bow and everybody say, you're the Lord, what difference would it make? It's a bit like Mark was saying this morning, if Jesus was standing next to you. Well, if you really believed, what difference would it make? What difference is it going to make to you tomorrow? You've been here this evening, you've heard some words. What difference is it going to make? The writer of Hebrews wants you to say, I want to exercise faith. It's not complicated, quite simple really. I believe God. I believe God is. I believe God rewards. I put my faith in him, I trust his promises, and then I get on with life in the light of that. Let's do that this week. Let's really think about that as we're on our way to work tomorrow morning, thinking, I want to be an ordinary hero of faith on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and right through this month and right through to Christmas. I want to be an ordinary hero who calculates, fearing God is much more important than fearing people around me.